Welcome back to Western Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about, and we are going to break down some articles. So for another week of just exciting, invigorating, stimulating, questioning medicine, let's kick this thing off without any further hesitation, without any reservation. It is good to be back. All right, here we go. Sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Andrew Bilt. Let's do this thing, shall we? What do you do? What do you do when a patient comes into your office and they say, "Hey, doc, my heart, it's racing"? The answer should be, well, you should stop drinking. Or so says this article in the New England Journal of Medicine that found when they took 140 patients who suffered from paroxysmal atrial fibrillation and who also drank 17 drinks a week, that when randomized to complete alcohol absence for 6 months, there was a significant reduction in AFib recurrence. How much of a difference, you ask? How much of a difference? Well, it would be 20%. And that's a 20% absolute difference. I have a rule of thumb when it comes to medicine. Anytime anyone says any sort of improvement that is 10% or greater, I almost always assume they're talking about a relative risk reduction or relative improvement. It's all a relative improvement. Almost never is there something that we do in medicine that is greater than 10% absolute benefit. But in this patient population, if you abstain from drinking for 6 months, there was a 20% absolute improvement in your recurrence of atrial fibrillation. Quick numbers means that that is an NNT of 5, a number needed to treat of 5 if you can get your patient to just stop drinking. So when your patient says, "My heart, it goes pitter patter pit, pit pit pitter patter, pitty 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 pitter patter pitty patter," the answer is to stop drinking. Now let's grab a sip of bourbon and head on to the next article. Which I then ask you. I ask you, yes, what do you do when the patient comes in and says, "Doc, there is a puddle on the floor"? The answer is either A, they spilled the sip of bourbon that they just took, or they're using eye drops. You tell them to close their eyes or close their eyes when they're using eye drops. And that is so said in this article in Optometry and Vision Science that had 30 patients enrolled into the study in which the eye drop was either placed by a trained clinician or the eye drop was placed by the patient. The intraocular pressure was measured before the drops were put into the eyes and then 2 hours after the drops were put into the eyes. So you had a trained clinician opening your eyeball and just dropping the droplet of eye drop into the eye, and then they would measure the intraocular pressure, or they let you, the patient, drop one drop into your eyeball, but they had you do it a very specific way. And I know that this does not sound like a big deal, but we know that the clinician eye drop test was exactly as it sounds. The eye drop was basically hitting the open eyeball. There is 100% you knew that that eye drop was getting in to the open eyeball. And if you ever put eye drops in your eyes, it's like a torture test. I mean, I hate it. I probably use an entire bottle of Visine every time I try to put one eye drop into my eye, because I just feel like I can never get it in there. And then sometimes it hits the outer side of my eye, and sometimes I feel like it hits my nose. And I mean, did it even get into my eye? So I drop 3 more drops, and then I blink 5 or 6 times because it's super scary to just squirt something in your eye. So the way that they had the patients do the eye drop was something I had never seen before, and for me is completely game-changing, for me personally, as well as anyone listening and any of my patients in the future. The patients self-administered the eye drop, and in the eye drop that they were placing the eye drop, they had a closed eyelid, or a lightly closed eyelid at time of administration. And you might be saying to yourself, "Wait a second, are you telling me that they lightly closed their eyelid and then placed an eye drop in that eye? The one that has the eyelid closed, doesn't that defeat the purpose of getting the eye, the droplet of medication into the eye because the eyelid is closed?" And that's what I would have thought. But that is not necessarily what happened. You see, the eye drop was placed anywhere over the medial area of a gently closed eyelid, with the theory being that the eye drop will fall into the naturally occurring anatomical funnel and right into the eye. Basically, the most midline or middle portion, right next to the nose part of the eye, as it has a little opening and the eye drop should just funnel right there into the most medial part of the eye, and then boom, bada bing, you would have the eye drop into the eye without having to try to keep your eye open and anatomically nail or hit the bullseye with that eye drop. The results were super impressive because when they looked at the intraocular pressure between what we know was an eye drop dropped directly on the eyeball by the clinician, or what we know was an eye drop placed in this anatomical funnel completely midline to like right next to the nose, between the nose and the eyeball, there was no difference in the change to the intraocular pressure. There was no difference in the intraocular pressure. This, for me, is absolutely amazing. This, for me, is brilliant. Sure, it was only 30 patients, and larger trials are needed, but for me, this is the evidence I need. I hate trying to put a drop in my eye. I feel like I waste the entire bottle. And in a recent report of glaucoma specialists, they reviewed videotapes of 300 patients, and they found that in these 300 patients, on average, there were 7 eye drops administered before the patients felt comfortable or confident to say that 1 eye drop got into their eye. So if we can use this evidence to say, hey, this is how you could put eye drops in, we can get a whole lot more bang for our buck when it comes to just placing 1 eye drop and getting what we really need. So when your patient says there's a puddle on the floor, you either need to tell them to drink their bourbon a little bit better or tell them to close their eyes when they're placing their eye drops. On to the next article, which leads me to my next question of what do you say? What do you say to the patient when the patient comes in and they say, hey doc, I got some pain. What do you tell them? Well, I think the correct answer is to tell them to go take turmeric. Yep, turmeric. Or at least says this trial in the Annals of Internal Medicine that took 70 adults with painful knee osteoarthritis and randomized them to turmeric 1,000 milligrams daily or placebo for 12 weeks. The primary outcome was a change in the knee pain on a 100-point visual analog scale. Those randomized to turmeric saw a 24-point reduction, while those randomized to placebo saw a 15-point reduction. The difference between a 24-point reduction on a 100-point scale and a 15-point reduction on a 100-point scale is statistically significant. And if you listen to questioning medicine at all, ever before in your entire life, you might expect at this exact moment is when I'm going to go on a rant and say it's statistically significant, but it's not clinically significant. And the real difference between the active arm and the control arm is the difference between 15 and 24, which means it's only a difference of 9. So on a 10-point scale, that's like saying going from 8 to 7 and blah, blah, blah. And you would be right. That is what I would normally say on most trials, but this is different. This is actually a game-changing or practice-changing article for me, or at least I think it should be, because the harms of 500 milligrams of turmeric twice a day or 1,000 milligrams of turmeric once a day is almost nothing, or at least nothing that I think is that harmful or worth mentioning. There's no real difference here between turmeric and the placebo. And let's remember, the turmeric arm had a 2.5-point change on a 10-point scale. 24 points on a 100-point scale is their improvement in pain. If you can get a patient with a pain score of 7 down to 4.5 just by prescribing turmeric, that is a win-win-win in my book all day long. If you don't have to give an opioid, you don't give nothing else, just give turmeric and you can get them down 2.5 points, that is a win. And while it is not much better than placebo, I will grant you that, sadly, we as providers are not allowed to write for placebo. And having a pharmacist fill a script for placebo is just not really going to happen ever. So we have to do the next best thing and prescribe something that has a low risk but a high improvement. And it seems to be that turmeric, 500 milligrams twice a day, just might be that golden ticket. So until we are allowed to write for placebo and the pharmacist will fill a script for placebo, I think for pain or knee osteoarthritis. Turmeric, 500 milligrams, BID, is a game changer. And when the patient comes and says, hey, doc, I got some pain in my knee here, what you should do is turmeric, 500 milligrams, BID, game changer. Which takes me to my next article, and this article confirms the age-old theory that size does matter. It is titled, Waist Circumference Change During Intensive Lifestyle Interventions in Cardiovascular Morbidity and Mortality in Look-Ahead Trial. This was a secondary analysis of the Look-Ahead Trial, and it sought to find the association between change in weight and waist circumference and cardiovascular outcomes. They found that, in the end, size matters, and particularly waist size. They found that participants with an increased waist circumference had increased risk of cardiovascular outcomes regardless of weight loss or weight gains. In the analysis, approximately 4,500 individuals were looked at. About 3,000 individuals had reductions in both weight and waist. Those are really not that interesting because their weight and waist both went down. And another almost 800 individuals had increases in their weight and waist. Also not that interesting because we know that if you're gaining weight and your waist size is going up, you're likely to have more cardiovascular outcomes. So really, those are not that intriguing to me. Those combinations only account for 79% of the sample size that was looked at, which means when you look at the remaining 21% or approximately one-fifth of the participants that had a discordant response in their weight and waist, meaning their weight went up but their waist went down, or their waist went up but their weight went down, individuals who gained waist, gained in the belt notches that wrapped around their waist, gained in their waist circumference, were in big trouble regardless of what the scale said. The scale said, oh, look at this, you are losing weight, but your waist size, the truncal obesity, is gaining. Those individuals were in a big problem, which only means that it is true, size matters, and particularly your waist size really does matter, maybe no matter what the scale says. And with that, let's move on to the next article. And this next article is probably going to be the last article I'm going to talk about. It is in JAMA Open Network. It is titled Incident Characteristics and Outcomes of Interval Breast Cancers Compared with Screening Detected Breast Cancers. And in this study, of almost 70,000 women in the Canadian Health Registry, roughly 700 breast cancers were detected on screening. 200 were detected in the two-year interval after a normal screening mammogram, which means 500 were detected outside the screening program. And when they broke down the cancer by the bad cancer or the not-so-bad cancer, when they looked at the high-grade cancers, they found that you were way more likely to have a bad high-grade cancer if your cancer was detected during interval screening, meaning your cancer wasn't caught during the routine every two-year follow-up. It was found at, like, I don't know, 1 year or 14 months, or you had a negative test and then 8 months later, all of a sudden, we detected breast cancer. This had a huge association with being really bad things, an odds ratio of 6.3. That is huge. That is terrible, right? I mean, this is an awe-shocking paper that we should all take note of and really change our practice, right? Well, let's break this down. You see, of course it is bad. It is completely bad because when you look at the 7-year follow-up for breast cancer specific death, you are also more likely to die with a hazard ratio of 3.55 if you were found to have breast cancer during the interval screening. The authors say, improvement of breast cancer deaths and overall population mortality requires strategies above and beyond conventional screening mammograms. But I think that they are completely wrong, and here's why I think they are completely wrong. It is the analogy of rabbits, turtles, and birds. I didn't come up with this analogy. I've used this analogy before. I don't know who did come up with it, so I can't really give it credit, but it is like if you are in a pin where is a caged-in circle, and you have one rabbit, one turtle, one bird, and on the other side of the pin, there is an open door. Now, you don't have to worry about the turtle, because a turtle is a cancer that goes so slow, it's never going to get to the open door. It's never going to metastasize. It's never going to anything. You don't have to worry about it.
Now, you also don't have to worry about the bird. It's an open pin. The bird is just going to fly up, out, and away. This is the interval cancer that all of a sudden the screening is negative, and 4 months later, the bird has already flown away. It is Mets everywhere. The person's going to die. We can never catch these cancers, or if we do catch them, it's only because we're incredibly, incredibly lucky, and it just happens to be exactly the right time, the right place, at the right everything. The only thing that we care about catching and screening for cancer are the rabbits. It's the ones that are fast enough to get to the door, but not so fast that they're flying out of the pen before we can ever get to them. It's the rabbits that we want to catch, and screening is meant to catch the rabbits. So sure, if you have an interval cancer that's 4 months after a negative mammogram, it's going to be bad because those are the birds. Those are the ones that go wild, fly away, metastasize to everywhere. But we don't care about catching the birds because we can't catch the birds. We can only catch the rabbits. And so while I'll kind of agree with the authors in that we need something better than what we currently have to help overall population mortality, I don't agree with them in the fact that we have anything available right now. It's just not out there. I mean, maybe there will come a test someday in which we'll be able to tell exactly in your genes the exact time frame in which you personally will then develop cancer, but I don't see that happening anytime soon, and I don't think it should come as a surprise that those cancers that are found in the interval setting are associated with greater badness, higher mortality, higher death rates, higher morbidity. This shouldn't come as a shock to anyone. Let's recap, and then this ship is going to set sail in the sea of evidence. If your patient has paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, well, then you should just tell them to stop drinking, or at least says a study in the New England Journal of Medicine with a number needed to treat of 5 for those people who were able to stop drinking and had paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. If you have a patient that is putting in eye drops, have them close their eyes just gently and place the eye drop, one eye drop, in the little natural funnel that is right next to the nose and in between the eyeball. That little natural funnel will funnel the eye drop right in to the eyeball. Bada boom, bada bang. For me, that is my own personal practice changer because I hate putting in eye drops. And while osteoarthritis is a pain in the knee, or, you know, maybe a pain in the butt, turmeric, 500 milligrams BID, seems to really help these patients. Whether it's placebo, whether it's real, I don't really know, but I can tell you that it doesn't have a lot of side effects or bad side effects, so I think it's worth giving in individuals with knee osteoarthritis. And if you're going to go on a diet and you want to lose a whole bunch of weight, make sure you're also losing waste. Weight and waste, but most importantly, I should say, is the loss of your waist circumference. The truncal obesity seems to really have an effect on overall mortality, which is something that we all can get on board with. And speaking of getting on board, the last article that I talked about was screening mammograms. If you have an interval cancer, a cancer that is detected in between your normal routine screening, it is likely going to be bad, but this shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, and currently we don't have an answer on how to fix that. And with that, let's end this podcast as we've ended every one before it. Wait for the music, and until next time, keep the quest and questioning.